Hare Jaya Rama Rava Kunjabi Hari Jaya Rama Rava Kunjabi Hari Gopi Janna Balaba Giravarir Hari Gopi Janna Balaba Giravarir Hari Kishora Nandana Vraja Jana Ranjana Kishora Nandana Vraja Jana Ranjana Yamuna Tira Vanachari Yamuna Tira Vanachari Jaya Radha Madhava Kunjabi Hari Radha Madhava Kunjabi Hari
Jayam Vishnupad Parahamsa Parajvichara Satara Satashri Shimus Vangres A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Maharaj Shri Prabhupada Ki Jai Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai Kriskan Founder Acharya Shri Prabhupada Ki Jai Samaveda Bhaktivinda Ki Jai Gaur Premananda All glories to some of the devotees. All glories to some of the devotees. All glories to some of the devotees. All glories to Shri Guru and Sri Gauranga. Lord Prabhupada. Maum Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasad Vilay Srimati Bhaktivedanta Swami Dinamani Namaste Saraswati Ngora Vanabhachani Namaste Saraswati Pasti Chandra Sajaji. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya
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 Om Is the speaker is it loud enough? Sometimes it gets turned down during kirtan. Okay. We're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 14. We have several verses today. Let's see, where are we starting on? 12? 12. Is it 12? Where we start?
Yes.
And we go to 20, 21, right? 12 to 21. Okay, so because we've got about 12 verses here, I'm just going to read through the English, and we'll do the last one together, because that's what I'm going to speak about mostly, the last verse. So we're starting with text 12. Just see, O Bhima, how the she-jackal cries at the rising sun and vomits fire, and how the dog barks at me fearlessly. Purport, these are some bad omens indicating something undesirable in the near future. If you see a she-jackal vomiting fire, you might think something's wrong. Okay? Now, these are very heavy omens here. O Bhimasena, tiger amongst men, now useful animals like cows are passing me on my left side, and lower animals like the asses are circumambulating me. My horse has appeared weak upon seeing me. Just see, this pigeon is like the messenger of death. The shrieks of the owls and the rival crows make my heart tremble. It appears that they want to make a void of the whole universe. Just see how the smoke encircles the sky. It appears that the earth and the mountains are throbbing. Just hear the cloudless thunder and see the bolts from the blue. The wind blows violently, blasting dust everywhere and creating darkness. Clouds are raining everywhere, but bloody disasters. The rays of the sun are declining, and the stars appear to be fighting amongst themselves. Confused living entities appear to be ablaze and weeping. Rivers, tributaries, ponds, reservoirs, and the mind are all perturbed. Butter no longer ignites fire. What is this extraordinary time? What is going to happen? The calves do not suck the teats of the cows, nor do the cows give milk. They are standing, crying, tears in their eyes, and the bulls take no pleasure in the pasturing ground. The deities seem to be crying in the temple, lamenting and perspiring. They seem about to leave. All the cities, villages, towns, gardens, mines, and hermitages are now devoid of beauty and bereft of all happiness. I do not know what sort of calamities are now awaiting us. So we'll do text 21. Manya etar mahot patayar. Nunam Bhagavata Padai Ananya Purusha Shrivir Hina Burhata Sobhaga Manya Etair Mahot Patair Nunam Bhagavata Padai Ananya Purusha Shrivir Hina Burhata Saubhaka Manya Etair Mahot Patair Nunam Bhagavata Padai Ananya Purusha Shrivir Hina Burhata Saubhaka Nunam Bhagavata Padai Ananya Purusha Shrivir Hina Burhata Sarvaha Vaishnavis. Manye,
I take it for
granted. I take it for granted.
Etai,
by all these. Maha, great. Upate, upsurges. Nunam, for want of.
Bhagavata,
of the personality of Godhead.
Padai,
the marks on the sole of the foot. Ananya, extraordinary. Purusha,
of the Supreme Personality.
Shribi,
by the auspicious signs.
Hina,
dispossessed.
Bu,
the earth.
Hata Saubhaga,
without the fortune.
Translation by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada.
I think that all these earthly disturbances indicate some greater loss to the good fortune of the world. The world was fortunate to have been marked with the footprints of the lotus feet of the Lord. These signs indicate that this will no longer be.
Om Gyanatmanandasya Gyananasalakrithaya Chakshurumitamina Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Vanchakopatyugishcha Kripasindhubhyayavacha Patitano Pavanebhyo Vaishnavibhyo Namo Namaha.
So, today, we are seeing many, many very bad omens that portent something very terrible is going to happen. But there's also, in this last verse, one very good omen that's mentioned. So we've just read all these very bad portents of calamities, very, very extreme situations of the earth and everything that's going on. So they were described in detail the last 10 verses. But this verse describes a good omen or good fortune. And that good fortune is the presence of Krishna on the earth, and the good omen is seeing the footprints of his lotus feet. In other words, there's so many disastrous things, and you're seeing all things with animals and pigeons and donkeys and dogs acting in ways that they shouldn't normally. But if we were seeing the footprints of Krishna's lotus feet, that is the most auspicious, the most wonderful thing. It basically trumps all the bad. But what Maharaj Yudhisthira is now so much concerned about, so much lamenting, so much in disturbance about, is that we will no longer see those footprints of his lotus feet because Krishna will be leaving the earth very soon. So I was thinking about all these omens. Omens are signs and warnings. They're predictors of something is about to come, sometimes called portents. Omens do not cause events to happen. It's not a causative thing. They are a predictor or a warning of them. They're an indicator that this is going to happen. They in themselves do not cause them to happen. And we see these throughout the Bhagavatam and other Vedic literatures, also a lot in Ramayana, Mahabharata, all throughout all of the different scriptures. Whenever we see different pastimes, a lot of times you'll see these different omens being mentioned. Now, I thought it was interesting that I was thinking about it's not necessarily unique just to Vedic culture or to our scriptures, this idea of omens. This is very common throughout the world, actually. I was thinking in European and American, basically Western folklore, you have ideas like a black cat crossing your path is inauspicious, right? Unless you've heard that one. So that's a very similar type of thing. Whether it's true or not, I don't know. But, you know, it's the same idea. And then as far as good omens, you have things like finding a four-leaf clover, right? That's good luck. Can we think of any others that we use in America? I was trying to think of...
A rainbow.
A rainbow is good fortune, good luck, but prosperity, seeing a rainbow.
Ladybug.
What is it?
Ladybug.
Ladybugs, they're auspicious in America?
I don't know.
I don't know. I hadn't heard that. I mean, I know that they're good in many ways. You know, they kill aphids and help you plants and things. But any others? Okay, we know that they're there. They're used a lot. I think the four-leaf clover is actually Irish, and I think there's a lot of these in Ireland, in that culture. So what are they? Omens are basically messages, and where do these messages come from? Sometimes we just see them symbolically, like in a donkey or a jackal like that, and sometimes they even come as voices from the sky, right? Kamsa heard a couple of those. Omens, voices from the sky. So sometimes they're very embodied, which leads us to understand that these messages are coming from higher powers. right? In other words, it's something that is beyond kind of our normal human, you know, existence. And that's why they're often sometimes called superstitions like that, because it's things people don't understand. But actually, it's really part of Vedic science. In the part, Natuka can correct me if I'm wrong here, but I think that in Vedic science it's called Jyoti or Jyotish, which is astrology, basically, and the science of omens is called Nimitta, is one part. There is a part of a Vedic astrology or Jyotish that's the study of these omens. I'm not an expert on this. I just researched this a little bit, so I don't know too much about it, but apparently it's a very scientific study, and I think it's found in some of the, I know the Rig Veda talks about astrology, and so it's there within the Vedas, the sciences. And there are people who have written books, as I said, and studied it, and you can learn all about the different omens and what they all mean and how they interact with human beings. So these influences are obviously caused by many things, and probably ultimately the demigods. You know, the demigods are really in charge, well, of course, demigods working under Krishna, are in charge of practically everything in the material world. There are 33 million demigods. So when you think about it, they all have to have a job. They're controlling a lot of different things, right? I mean, the movements of parts of your body, and just about everything is really controlled by a demigod. So one of the takeaways, I think, from this, you know, little part that we're understanding about these omens and things, it's just that the world is not mechanistic. There are many things that are beyond what our normal sort of material vision is of the predictable laws of nature and common experience. And so because of that, things that are not understood, they're outside of common experience or common explanation, are often called superstition or folklore or things like that. I was trying to do a Google search this morning on Vedic omens. And one of the first things comes up, how these are superstitions, you know. Well, they're not superstitions. They're actually true. I was reading, it's people who've actually studied these have found them practically in their life that they are true. You know, when they see something like this, something does bad happen to them or something good happens to them. You know, so it's like astrology. It may be beyond our understanding how these forces can work, but they're absolutely true. It's not the highest truth or absolute truth in terms of, absolute spiritual knowledge, but as far as understanding the workings of material nature, and it's a higher understanding of dynamics than the usual mechanistic scientific explanation. So I think that's kind of interesting, and like I said, I don't know a lot about this, but I find it very interesting. You know, it's kind of it's always been an interesting thing to see how all of these things work, you know, which is so far beyond our normal experience in the material world. I was now within the Bhagavatam, the Srimad Bhagavatam itself, many examples. Of course, Krishna's disappearance, and other places too, there's discussions of Krishna's disappearance and all the omens that happened. Well, one of the best ones I thought was, or good examples was, not best, because omens aren't good, but good example. Was Krishna in the coils of the Kaliya snake. Remember that one? Here's all these different bad omens, and so we're coming, and so everybody rushed down to the riverbank, right? Nanda Maharaj and everyone, why? Because they saw these bad omens. 10.16.12 says, in the Vrindavan area, there then arose all three types of fearful omens. Three types of omens, bad omens. Those on the earth, those in the sky, and those in the bodies of living creatures, which announced imminent danger. A little purport here. According to Srila Sridhar Swami, the omens were as follows. On the earth, there was disturbing tremors. In the sky, there were meteors falling. And in the bodies of creatures, there were shivering, as well as quivering of the left eye and other parts of the body. These omens announced imminent danger. A lot to do with tremoring or quivering in different parts of the body, left and right, and whether it's auspicious and inauspicious, like that. There's a science of that. Kamsa, when he was fearing approaching death, was seeing all sorts of terrible omens, and he knew the end was coming, or he should have figured it out, at least. Another one that was very dramatic was Daksha. Of course, Daksha fends Lord Shiva. to the point that Lord Shiva's wife, Parijata, self-immolates, right? She burns herself up. Now, Shiva is a little irritated, more than irritated. He's furious at Dukkha for the loss of he was responsible for the loss of his wife by doing some stupid, offensive thing, which Lord Shiva was willing to just overlook. But when his wife would not overlook it, and she burned herself and started in protest, he could not tolerate. So Daksha began to see a lot of bad omens, and he should have, because something bad was really going to happen. But Shiva really let loose on him with all the demons that were there from the cosmic destruction were coming down on Daksha. And he very quickly mended his ways and surrendered, I think. So one of the lessons here is do not offend Lord Shiva. You know, he could cause you some real damage. Anyway, there's also good omens. We're talking about bad omens. There's also good omens, and there's some examples of those in the Bhagavatam. Rukmini, when she was worried, she had sent the Brahmin messenger to give a message to Lord Krishna, please come and save me. They're going to marry me off to Shishupal, was it? And what the words? Married to Shishupal. Anyway, so she's appealing to Krishna, who she had never seen, but was totally in love and surrendered and wanted only him for her husband. She wouldn't accept anyone else just by hearing. That's the power of hearing. Of course, she says eternal consort. But the example is given to us is by the power of hearing. Rukmini so much loved Krishna, was so attracted to him that she would not accept anyone else. So she sends the message to the Brahmin, with the Brahmin to Krishna, but hadn't come back for a couple, 3 days. What she didn't know was Krishna was getting ready to come, you know, and to take her away and to actually fulfill her desire. So, but when she was worried about it, her left eye started twitching, which was that's a bad omen or a good omen? That's a good omen. Yeah, that's what I had. Yeah, so now before we heard about... Which was the other one? Okay, oh, here we go. Oh, all right, that's why. Oh, okay, so that's why for, who was it that it was a bad omen? Anyway, okay, so now we've got it right, the left and right, male, female. You know, see, you got to know this stuff, which I don't. Anyway, her left side twitches, and so that was a good sign. Then she felt relieved. She felt a lot better that Krishna would be on his way. Another one was when Akura was on his way to Vrindavan. Of course, he was very, very excited about the... I mean, he wasn't happy about his mission to have to, you know, take him back to Mathura where Kamsa was planning on killing him. And Akura knew that, but of course he knew Krishna would be able to defeat him. But as he's coming, a deer passed on his left side. And so that was a good omen. So he was very excited about this was going to be wonderful, being able to see Krishna, get it...
Clockwise is good. Anti-clockwise is bad.
Oh, okay.
Clockwise.
Okay, you're from his left side, coming on clockwise. All right. Good. Well, you guys are all expert at this. And what's the very best sign of all? What's the most auspicious thing that we could see? The footprints of Krishna's lotus feet. Nothing more auspicious, more wonderful for the devotees than Krishna's lotus feet. In this verse, there's two words. It says that Krishna's lotus feet is Shrivi, an auspicious sign, and when Krishna was going to leave, it was called Hatha Saubhaga, without good fortune. Saubhaga means good fortune. Hatha, no good fortune. So the worst thing, the best thing was having Krishna's lotus feet, and the worst thing was losing the association of Krishna. Now, why do we always refer to Krishna's lotus feet? Why not his beautiful face? Well, sometimes we do talk about, Krishna has so many beautiful parts of his body, his face, everything. And it's discussed in the Bhagavatam, but so often the references are to his lotus feet. You know, in that, I don't know what it's called, it's online, where they have is that Vanapedia, where they have all the verses, where you can get, anyway. I did a search on it for Krishna's lotus feet, because I wanted to find a couple nice verses about Krishna's lotus feet. Well, I got 3,000. So, you know, I mean, seriously. I mean, I didn't know where to begin. You know, there's so many references over and over to the lotus feet of Krishna. So why are Krishna's lotus feet so revered by the devotees? Well, many reasons, of course, but the other two basic reasons. One is because they purify everyone. They purify the world, they purify us individually, and they give relief from material suffering. You know, they have that cooling effect that all material suffering is finished when you have Krishna's lotus feet. But more than that, they give greatest transcendental pleasure to the devotees. The devotees are, you know, just feel so happy with his beautiful, Krishna's beautiful lotus feet, especially if they can touch those feet or have his feet on their head. Now, and both of these ideas are mentioned in Bhagavatam 3:16-17. Krishna speaking says, "My lotus feet have become so sacred that they immediately wipe out all sin, and I have acquired such disposition that the goddess of fortune does not leave me." In other words, they're able to immediately wipe out all sins, but they're also so attractive to the goddess of fortune. Going back to the story of Kaliya, we can see here's an example of relief from all sinful activities by contact with the lotus feet of Krishna. And Kaliya, of course, in some ways was sinful, and he obviously made a lot of offenses in Vrindavan to the residents of Vrindavan, but he got such a benediction. I mean, what devotee gets Krishna's lotus feet directly on his head? So he was very fortunate. And, that the wives of the Kaliya serpent said, "O Lord, although this Kaliya, the king of serpents, has taken birth in the mode of ignorance and is controlled by anger, he has achieved that which is difficult for others to achieve. Embodied souls who are full of desires and thus wandering in the cycle of birth and death can have all benedictions manifested before their eyes simply by receiving the dust of your lotus feet." So they were so appreciative that their husband, Kaliya, got that opportunity, which is the highest benediction. And also, besides the fact that Kaliya was purified by contact, many devotees just express appreciation for the comfort and the beauty and the happiness of Krishna's lotus feet. In 10:60-43, Rukmini is speaking. Actually, this is from Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur's purport, sort of paraphrasing what Rukmini is saying. "I surrender to those feet by which their mercy of their own accord approach the person worshiping them, and which destroy a multitude of illusions. May I surrender unto the lotus of your feet, which give happiness and a steady taste to persons like us." Persons like us, she's acting as though she's an ordinary human being. But the lotus feet bring happiness and taste, constant pleasure. Another verse, 10:29-37. "Goddess Lakshmi, whose glance is sought after by the demigods with great endeavor, has achieved the unique position of always remaining on the chest of her lord Narayan. Still, she desires the dust of his lotus feet, even though she has to share that dust with Tulsi Devi, and indeed with the Lord's many other servants. Similarly, we have approached the dust of your lotus feet for shelter." Of course, she has to share with Tulsi, Vrinda Devi, because Tulsi's always at the feet of the Lord. We always have the Tulsi leaves on Krishna's feet. I just saw a letter or something from Srila Prabhupada. I mean, everybody knows this, but it was a very, very early letter where he was instructing devotees to always put Tulsi on Krishna's feet, but only on Krishna. Only Vishnu Tattva deities, which of course is what we've always done for many, many years. Now, another question. Okay, we can kind of understand the beauty of Krishna's lotus feet. In fact, the fact that we call them lotus, I mean, what is a lotus? It's beautiful flowers, very soft, isn't it? Isn't it very just soft, almost silky feel to a lotus petal? So, describing Krishna's feet as the lotus, is, you can see it very, very nice, how cooling and soft and beautiful they are. But why dust of the lotus feet? You're saying that in the material world, the feet are considered the lowest. They become dirty, they become contaminated. We walk through all kinds of things, and you know, to come. So of course, we take off our shoes before we enter a temple. And in fact, usually in India, they wash their feet, right? They have a foot bathing area often, you know, that you, you know, because a lot of times people will walk barefoot too. So you need to wash your feet if you're not taking off your shoes. So the idea is that, and it's also, you know, it's offensive to touch your foot to another person, right? So the feet are considered lowly, considered dirty or contaminated. But we know that what's lowest in the material world is highest in the spiritual world. And we have the example of 15.1 of the Bhagavad Gita, of the banyan tree. Srila Prabhupada says in his purport, this material world is a manifestation of the center by 180 degrees, and the other 180 degrees constitutes the spiritual world. The material world is the perverted reflection. So the spiritual world must have its same variegatedness, but in reality. So in other words, you know, we have that reflection where the highest is the lowest, Prabhupada explains that. So in the, while the feet are considered low in the material world, in the spiritual world, Krishna's lotus feet are the highest. So the devotee feels very lowly, and when he approaches the feet of Krishna. We understand the greatness of Krishna. We understand, you know, everything about him, his beauty, his, you know, power, everything. So naturally, we are a very small jiva. We come in great humility when we approach Krishna. And thus, taking the dust of the lotus feet of Krishna indicates complete surrender to Krishna. So dust of lotus feet really is almost synonymous with surrendering. If I take the lotus feet, of Krishna, to take a lotus feet of Srila Prabhupada, that means I surrender to them. Now, of course, again, Krishna's lotus feet are not like our feet. They're very soft, they're sweet, they're fragrant. They have a wonderful fragrance, his whole body does. And it's one of the... Vishnu's Chakravarti Kaur is talking about the stages of seeing Krishna. This is obviously a very, very advanced stages. But when one begins to see Krishna, it happens through the five senses in sequence. And one of those early ones, the first thing, it begins to, you know, that one first can smell the wonderful fragrance of Krishna. So that's, you know, that's his lotus feet. Here's a nice statement about Krishna's lotus feet. Okay. Lord Balaram, as you may remember, is generally a well-wisher of the Kurus. I mean, he was obviously very much, he was related with the Pandavas more closely, but he was also a little sympathetic to the Kurus. In fact, he was Duryodhana's club teacher, right? Club fighting. So, you know, he had a lot of connections with them. And that's why later, when the battle Kurukshetra starts, there's no mention of Balaram in the battle. Even on pilgrimage, he decided, just coincidentally, this would be a good time for me to take pilgrimage, go to all the holy places throughout South India and all throughout India. Because he sort of wanted to be neutral, like Switzerland, you know. He just wanted to, I don't really want to take sides in this battle because, you know, I would have to fight against my pupil and things like that. And besides all the reasons that Arjuna said also, of course. But so at any rate, he was generally a well-wisher, but sometimes he had enough. Now, during the Rajasuya sacrifice, someone was supposed to be chosen to be the first recipient, right, of the offering. And who did they choose? Krishna, naturally. Now, several people on the other side did not like that, including Shishupal, who unfortunately crossed the line and lost his head. But before that happened, Balaram started speaking to them, and he is quite upset. He says, the goddess of fortune herself, ruler of the entire universe, worships Krishna's feet. And the master, the goddess of fortune, does not deserve the paraphernalia of a mortal king. Oh, they also said, they were saying, I may have this mixed up. Because they were saying how the Pandavas shouldn't get anything on the recognition. They're not king, they're nothing. You know, we're the ones who are the royalty in charge. But anyway, he says, the dust of Krishna's lotus feet, which is the source of holiness for all the places of pilgrimage, is worshipped by all the great demigods. The principal deities of all planets are engaged in his service, and they consider themselves most fortunate to take the dust of the lotus feet of Krishna on their crowns. Great demigods like Lord Brahma and Lord Shiva and even the goddess of fortune and I are simply parts of his spiritual identity, and we also carefully carry that dust on our heads. And still, you say Krishna is not fit to use the royal insignia or sit on the royal throne? So another lesson here, don't anger Lord Balaram. What happened next is he takes his plow and is going to drag their whole city into the Ganges. Right? So they very quickly changed their tune, surrendered, begged forgiveness, of course, from Balaram. But he gives such a strong statement here about, you know, Krishna's position. And to emphasize Krishna's position, he says, we all take the dust of his lotus feet on our heads. He says, because Balaram's the first expansion of Krishna. He is, you know, there isn't anybody next, you know, higher than, there's nobody, how am I trying to say this? He's next after Krishna, basically, in the hierarchy. You know, I mean, so he's the most revered personality in the universe, you know, right next to Krishna. And he says, I take the dust of Krishna's lotus feet on my head. So, I just want to also mention here, kind of as an insert, that we also take the dust of the lotus feet of the Vaishnavas, the spiritual master, and all the devotees, really. I'm talking a lot about Krishna, but we also want to remember this applies to the Vaishnavas. Statement by Prahlad Maharaj. Unless they smear upon their bodies the dust of the lotus feet of a Vaishnava, completely freed from material contamination, persons very much inclined towards materialistic life cannot be attached to the lotus feet of the Lord, who is glorified by his uncommon activities. Only by becoming Krishna conscious, by taking shelter at the lotus feet of the Lord in this way, can one be freed from material contamination. So this is a very, very important point that Prahlad Maharaj is making. We take shelter of the Vaishnavas, those great servants of Krishna. We take shelter of the dust of their lotus feet, he says, and that way we can obtain the feet of Lord Krishna. So in other words, we don't go directly to Krishna, we go through the Guru. We go through our spiritual master to Krishna. That's why when all of our offerings, whatever we do, we first offer to the spiritual master, then to Krishna, because he is the intercessory. You know, he's the link. The spiritual master is the link to Krishna. So we revere the dust of the lotus feet. You know, and people always wanted to touch Srila Prabhupada's feet, of course. And he didn't really like that, especially when non-devotees did. And those would kind of stop. It's like Brahmananda would always be in the way, you know, pushing aside or something. But he sometimes let his devotees, his disciples. You know, but at any rate, so we approach Krishna's feet, and it represents service and surrender. So what does taking shelter of the lotus feet mean? It means complete surrender, taking shelter of Krishna, and that can be a theoretical understanding, but we also need to practically realize that in our life through our practice of devotional service. But remember the six symptoms of surrender from the Hari Bhakti Vilas of Sanatana Goswami, which I guess was edited by Gopabhata Goswami. I always try to figure out who wrote all these things. And then we also have the Archana Pradati, which was an edited version of that, originally by Bhaktisiddhanta, then translated in English by our devotees. So anyway, all this originally comes from Sanatana Goswami. And we have this nice verse, Anupulyasya Song Kapal Padipulyasya Varjanam Vishisya Shyati Ta Vishvaso Goptritve Varanam Tata Atma Nishkepa Karpanye Shadvida Sharanagati. Six divisions of surrender with Sharanagati are the acceptance of those things favorable to devotional service, rejection of unfavorable things, conviction that Krishna will give protection, the acceptance of the Lord as one's guardian or master, knowing Krishna as the maintainer, and full self-surrender, complete dependence on the Lord and humility. So these are how we know if I or someone is surrendering, if these symptoms are manifesting. Of course, they're very very advanced symptoms to be fully. I think that we could say, well, yes, I do many of these things, at least some of the time. But, of course, pure devotee means all the time, completely surrendered. Now, I thought it was interesting that this is a very familiar verse, right? Most of you probably heard this verse, Six Symptoms of Surrender. But rarely do we hear the next verse from Hari Bhakti Vilas, and this is actually in the next verse of Majjhalila Chaitanya Charitamrita. This was 22.101, so 102 is quoting the next verse of Hari Bhakti Vilas, which is, "One whose body is fully surrendered takes shelter at the holy place where Krishna had his pastimes and prays to the Lord, 'My Lord, I am yours.' Understanding this with his mind, he enjoys spiritual bliss." So, in other words, surrendering isn't a one-way street. I do all these things, I'm just surrendering, I'm giving everything. No. Krishna is reciprocating 1,000 times by giving spiritual happiness, giving protection, you know, giving so many things to the devotee. When the devotee says, and I really like this, because think about this. This is what we need to somehow have that consciousness, "My Lord, I am yours." In other words, our interests are not separate from Krishna's. Our convictions, our thoughts, our service, everything should be in line with Krishna. We want to be Krishna's, and we want Krishna to be ours. Ours in the sense that he's always in our heart, and you know, we're always thinking of him and serving him. So that needs to be our mood, the "Krishna, I am yours" in everything that we do. In Srila Prabhupada's purport in Majjha 20, he says, "Situated in everyone's heart, Krishna deals differently according to the living entity's position. The living entity's position is to be under the protection of the illusory energy or under Krishna's personal protection." That's basically our choice. You know, there's long discussions about free will, and I enjoy those because I think the study of free will is very, very interesting and important. To really understand that concept is like fundamental to understanding Krishna consciousness and the metaphysics of it. So, but you could simplify that whole statement, the whole discussion, down to one simple statement. Your free will is, you have two choices. You can be under the protection of illusory energy or under the protection of Krishna, right? You can be in Maya, or you can be in Krishna consciousness. That's your independent free will. And of course, it's more complex than that. But sometimes, like Prabhupada puts it here, it is really nice. "When a living entity is fully surrendered, he's under the direct protection of Krishna, and Krishna gives him all intelligence by which he can advance in spiritual realization." So in other words, one doesn't necessarily have to be fully realized in advance, because if one is surrendering, saying, "Krishna, I'm yours," then Krishna protects him and gives us the intelligence to advance and our spiritual realization to grow. So you can say that full surrender is like an end state, but it's also a beginning, right? Just like they say, you know, just like faith is the first stage, but it's also there at the end, you know, and there's different degrees of that manifest. So we have different degrees of surrender from the very beginning to the very most fully developed surrender, like the residents of Vrindavan. You know, so it is kind of a continuum, and it's a process of surrendering. And that's a lot of what we are involved in with our sadhana. You know, a lot of our sadhana is to help us to understand Krishna's position, and to be able to surrender to Krishna and his devotional service. So even in the neophyte position, we can take shelter of Krishna. And with surrender, when we do surrender under the order of the spiritual master, it's never ordinary karma. And I'll probably give this example of the kitten and the rat. You know, for the rat, kitten holding by the neck is certain death. But for the kitten, it's safely safely surrounded by his mother, safely taken care of by the mother cat. So it's like that. Material world's a very dangerous place for the non-devotee. For the devotee, we know it's still a dangerous place, but we're protected in that dangerous place. And that greatest protection is, of course, spiritual protection. Krishna is always anxious to help us to advance in Krishna consciousness. And as our mood of surrender develops, we realize more and more Krishna is our shelter, and that Krishna will work for our best interest, even if we don't see it all the time. And that is Krishna's great kindness, that he helps us to advance, sometimes even despite our own misgivings, our own material desire. So I'm going to end. Bonnie's going to end. Okay, I'm going to end with a final verse that really discusses what I was just saying, from Oh my gosh, what did I do? Here we go. Madhya Lila, 22:39-42. Krishna says, if one engages in my transcendental loving service, but at the same time wants the opulence of material enjoyment, he is very, very foolish. Indeed, he is just like a person who gives up ambrosia to drink poison. Since I am very intelligent, Krishna says, why should I give this fool material prosperity? Instead, I shall induce him to take the nectar of the shelter of my lotus feet and make him forget illusory material enjoyment. Whenever Krishna is requested to fulfill one's desire, he undoubtedly does so. But he does not award anything which, after being enjoyed, will cause one to petition him again and again to fulfill further desires. When one has other desires, but engages in the Lord's service, this is talking about me, Krishna forcibly gives one shelter at his lotus feet, where one will forget all those other desires. When someone engages in Lord Krishna's devotional service for the satisfaction of the senses, and instead acquires a taste for serving Krishna, he gives up his material desires and willingly offers himself as an eternal servant of Krishna. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Thank you all very much. Questions, comments? Ataka Gopal. A resident astrologer.
Thank you for the class, Guru. I was just thinking, you were speaking of how Rukmini Devi had fell in love with Krishna without ever seeing him in person. And I don't know if this is recounted in Prabhupada's summary study in Krishna book, but it's in the Bhagavatam version where Krishna says, just as Rukmini Devi is attached to me, I am also attached to her. In fact, I can't even sleep at night.
Thank you. Thank you. That's very, very nice. And it shows again that, you know, everything is reciprocal loving exchanges in Krishna consciousness. You know, so Rukmini is always thinking of him, so therefore he's always thinking of her. Yes?
Thank you for nice class. I just have a comment about omens.
Mm-hmm.
Prabhupada said that when Jamuna's wedding was taking place, and Gurudas Prabhu, he said about that butter, that this marriage won't last too long because they use butter instead of fire. Ghee and fire didn't go up too much. That was an example of omen.
Yeah, say it again. I didn't quite...
Jamuna's wedding with Gurudas Prabhu.
Who's wedding? What?
Jamuna's wedding.
With Gurudas Prabhu.
Okay.
And they use butter instead of ghee. And Prabhupada said this is a sign that the marriage won't last too long.
A sign of what?
Marriage won't last too long.
Oh, they won't last too long. Oh, okay.
And then another sign was that garland fell on Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur when the Rath Yatra was passing.
Hmm.
And then Bhaktivinoda Thakur thought that.
The garland.
Oh, this is Rad. This is the ray of Krishna I was praying for.
Yeah, that's a nice example of the garland falling in when the Bhakti Siddhanta Maharaj was there. Thank you very much. Nice examples. Okay.
Thank you very much, Prabhu. I very much appreciated the time that you put into preparing for that lecture. There was a couple of things. One was you were mentioning the story of how Mahadev's wrath returned to Daksha.
Mm-hmm.
And we hear how in that moment of anger, he removed a hair from his head and then from there manifested. And I always felt that was kind of like anticlimactic, you know, like he's so angry and just like... and then I was speaking to one devotee who, though a Gaudiya, he has very much attachment for Mahadev, and he said that he always felt the same, and he found a reference where the translation said that he removed a jot. So Mahadev, he has his hair in dreaded locks, so he actually removes one lock.
Oh, wow.
So then it just helps the visual. And I just wanted to mention that. And also you were mentioning how sometimes we become so focused on the lotus feet of the Lord, and we forget about the devotees. And obviously this is a very dangerous tendency. Mm-hmm. And one way to remember, obviously, is that verse that you quoted, which I was so happy to hear again, how the lotus feet of the Lord, though Lakshmi Devi is always eager to have this association, she finds that Vrinda Devi, Tulsi Devi is there. But also we can always remember our beloved Srila Prabhupada. And Prabhupada means he at whose feet all masters sit. And we understand that Krishna is the original Prabhupada. Mm-hmm. So we cannot even imagine or visualize Krishna's feet without the host of Vaishnavas who are already there, and we have to take their permission to come any closer. Thank you very much, Prabhu.
And thank you for reinforcing that idea. I was thinking, as you were speaking about that, how some of the Goswamis, for example, I forget which ones, some would like offer obeisances to 1,000 Vaishnavas a day, or, you know, it's like,
what was
that?
Raghunath Das.
Sanatana Goswami also? Yeah, so this idea of, you know, of offering obeisances to devotees, of celebrating the devotees, worshiping the devotees, mostly serving the devotees, is so important in our whole Vaishnava culture. Yeah, and we can never forget that. Thank you.
Just one point on the omens. Mm-hmm. Obviously, growing up with omens being part of your life, you know, you always think about them, and there's always the more esoteric aspects of omens that are signifying particular happenings, but there are also very practical understandings for the omens. For example, seeing a calf drinking milk mm-hmm. is considered very auspicious, and one could just use your practical understanding that if the calf is drinking milk, means that there are cows nearby. It means that the calf is allowed to drink the milk of her mother. Mm-hmm. Similarly, we see a rainbow is auspicious because it means that it's just rain. It means that the place is blessed by rain. In the same way, we can look at many of these different omens that we find and actually understand that there is the Vedas are not only so like you were saying, this superstitions, but it's almost practical understanding. Mm-hmm. And it is almost a way to become conscious of the blessings that have already manifested. We see a cow and we think, oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
But then you see a cow drinking milk and also you think, oh, that's auspicious. I remember that.
Yeah.
And then you actually recall why it's auspicious, and then you feel grateful for the cow.
And you think about cow protection and it's
exactly,
important.
Exactly, and it manifests
whole thing.
Further and further.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true, because for a devotee, all these things remind us ultimately of Krishna and of Krishna consciousness. Good point. Prangavinda Prabhu.
These omens actually nourishes the heart of eternal associates. In the material world, it's different, but in spiritual world, this has an eternity. All these bad omens has an eternal existence, because everything is a reflection.
Mm-hmm.
Over there, it intensifies their
right.
Closeness to Krishna. Like I was mentioning yesterday, short, I didn't elaborate the whole thing, that about on the Kaliya's day, that everybody started immediately, anything happened to the Brajavasi, they immediately think of Krishna. It's a natural flow of affection. So it intensified them so much, and they search for Krishna. I was mentioning even to about Putana story, that okay, pastime is gone, but later on, anytime Mother Yashoda felt little itchy on the right side is a bed for the ladies.
Mm-hmm.
So she immediately said, where is Krishna? Where is Krishna? And she gave a big hug and kisses on his head. It's intensified, and Krishna also relished it.
Wonderful point. For the devotee, the omens, even in the spiritual world, as you're saying, intensify their love for Krishna,
yes.
Help them to remember Krishna. You know, well, with the Kaliya story, those omens are immediately everybody in the whole village, and they run to the Yamuna because they thought something terrible was going to happen to Krishna. Yeah.
There's another little story on the Kaliyas. I mean, there's plenty of them, but one is very interesting, that why did Krishna by force giving his lotus feet to Kaliya? Well, as you read the 16th chapter, 10th canto, 16th chapter, the prayers of the Kaliya's wives. One of the prayers that the Lakshmi did not get the mercy, wow, how come our husband, he's a rascal, but you forced him to get the footprint. And if you trace in Sanatana Goswami Pad gives the history of Kaliya, mm-hmm. at least two lives. Previous life he was a Bedoshira, where there is a curse. And one curse is like, oh, he is hissing, kissing like a snake. He should become snake. So he became snake. But he was a great sage, Bedoshira, Ashwashira. They are famous in the mm-hmm. history. But previous to that, Bedoshira, that he was Kanchi Raj, the king of South India, that part of, where Narad Muni actually told him, if you want to really get relief of your sickness, you should get the foot wash water of a great saint. So he went to that place, and the saint was in a hollow of a big tree. Inside he does his bhajan, you know, like a cave. Hmm. And so they mentioned that the king of this province has come to take you. So can he allow your foot to be washed so that he can, because he's doing a wonderful service in the kingdom, he's the king. So the saint agreed. Then when he allowed, he stick out his feet, and the king was pouring water, but the part of the feet was like a kind of coming off from his feet. And he was like, kind of, he could not take it. And then he took those water on his head, not on mouth. We're supposed to drink a little bit, sip, and then wash water on top. And he could not take it on his mouth. That's why his mouth, Kaliya, became the poisonous. Mm. And the head, because he took on the head, it became the best place for Krishna to put his feet. So everything has a secret, why. So washing or respecting the body is more important than respecting Krishna in that sense. Mm-hmm. Because our relationship with Krishna becomes more solid and strong.
It's always interesting in all these different pastimes to kind of hear what I call the backstory. You know, why did this come about like this? Thank you. It's probably in class now. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.
Thank you.